Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and a bit about their life as well. Philip Humm was born in Germany and now holds dual British-German citizenship. He's had a glittering career in the high-tech business world, becoming CEO of Vodafone for Europe, CEO of T-Mobile in the United States and Germany, a vice president of Amazon and many other executive roles. At the same time, he was pursuing his love of art, and in 2015 he decided to make art his main focus. He mainly paints and sculpts, but he has now added film, digital photography and literature to his portfolio. He has exhibited in the UK, USA, Germany, Singapore and Italy. His main achievement has been what he calls his Gesamtkunstwerk, an all-embracing artwork entitled The Last Faust. It comprises more than 150 artworks, an illustrated novella and a full-length feature film starring Stephen Berkoff. It's a condensed and contemporary take on Goethe's Faust and questions human nature and its blind pursuit of technological advancement, in particular in AI, artificial intelligence. The Last Faust is being shown at the Saatchi Gallery as part of the Start Art Fair in October. Philip Humm's been telling me all about it from his London studio. Philip, welcome to the Considering Art podcast. Delighted to meet you. Now, you were born in Germany to a German father and a Belgian mother. You were educated at a French school in Germany.
Yeah.
You studied philosophy in Germany. You did business in the United States, an MBA in Switzerland, and art in London and Florence. That's a wonderful mix of countries and cultures. How do you think that's benefited you in your life?
I still consider myself a citizen of the world with a strong anchorship in Europe. And I kind of neglect that Britain is not part of Europe anymore, but geographically it definitely is in a way. And I think what it helped me to do is once you see yourself as a foreigner from the view of another country, I think you start developing a more honest view about your own people and yourself in that context. And you become also more humble because you notice that you are not the center of the world anymore. And so for me, it's always important that people travel to better understand, more than anything, to better understand themselves and be more open-minded as a result of that. And that helped me a lot. And obviously being half German, half Belgium, British citizen, German citizen, US educated, living in Saudi Arabia, et cetera, you have a lot of baggage, impressions and memories you carry with you, which one way or the other reflects one day in your art.
Is that good baggage or bad baggage?
Most of the time, actually, good baggage. While I'm a bit cynical in some sense, I would consider myself as a very optimistic person. So I think I'm always a can-do person, and I'm never somebody who would become really depressed or frustrated. But I see myself as optimistic, but quite critical at the same time.
Did you have any kind of religious upbringing, Philip?
I'm raised Catholic, but I then never really practiced Catholicism. I always liked what Karl Marx was saying, is that a religion is the opium of the masses. And so I always think it's important to understand oneself and its role in society. And religious doesn't have to, but can definitely cloud that a little bit.
How important was art for you as you grew up as a young boy and a young man?
I mean, I was fortunate enough that my parents really valued it highly, that I had a talent in art, or let's say in painting at the time. And did a lot of that with me. I was maybe also fortunate that I grew up in a period where there was no computer and a Nintendo or other games. So I did not really get diverted into other things. So that was my main pastime, was always painting and drawing and doing these things. And I think at the end of the day, I was fortunate enough that I have genetically simply a well-developed left and right side of the brain. So I consider myself having two talents. One is for painting and one is for mathematics.
Well, interestingly, you did try to study art at the Berlin Academy of Arts. Oh. You didn't get in. Was that a huge disappointment at the time?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I was very disappointed, especially because the university, you get in 1 year. If you don't, then you have to wait a full year. So it kind of completely threw me off. I mean, in hindsight, absolutely justified that I was not accepted, because they asked me to send in a portfolio including, let's say, multidisciplinary paintings, sculptures and other things. And I had never done that, right? So I was a watercolorist. That's the only thing I knew how to do. So I basically had to scramble to develop a portfolio in a very short period of time, which when you look at it today, was in more than lousy. So I would have rejected myself at the time as well. So I was ill prepared, if you want, because they didn't just take a watercolorist. They wanted people who had a broader base.
Did you not try elsewhere, other colleges?
Yeah, no, I promised simply in Germany at the time, you could only go, I was sure I would make it, right? Being an optimist, I said, no, sure, that's the best college and I will make it, period. And that was wrong. So basically, I had to wait a year, and which was then a year where I was left in a little bit in a creative chaos. So I did work for a photographer. I did design classes. I did all kind of different things, you know, just hovering around it and not really being able to enter. And that distracted me then as well. And life plays funny then, right? So the photography led to advertising. Advertising led to marketing. Marketing led to business, right? And everything completely unplanned. But more life is playing tricks on oneself.
Yeah. Do you often or ever speculate as to what your career might have been had the Berlin Academy accepted you?
No, I think it's a nice thought, but I don't think I'm important enough for the thought to be worth spending too much time on. It would be more important to think what, imagine if Hitler, who was drawing and applied to the Art Academy, if he had been taken, then the world would have been so much better.
Indeed. Anyway, Philip, as you said, you had a talent for mathematics, and eventually that led, as you said, to a successful business career. You were senior exec roles with Deutsche Telekom, Amazon, T-Mobile, Vodafone, to name but a few. As someone who's clearly has a great creative drive, in what ways did you use that creativity, channel that creativity into your business career?
Yeah, I mean, I was always the odd out in the business world. I never fitted a mold. I did once a test, psychological test for one company for a CEO role, and this key psychologist who had designed the test said, "You are absolutely out of my norm. I don't know whether I should or should not recommend you." Half of me says yes, and the other half says no. So I was always a bit different, which I think is a tribute to a well-developed creative side as well, and not fitting the mold then. And nevertheless, successful because I took very bold and risky approaches often in business, which normally people might not have taken, and which sometimes worked out well for me and sometimes didn't. And like I experienced at the age of 30, I was already CEO and I was fired at, I think it was 32. And so I experienced rising very fast and falling and then rising fast again and falling. So I had a lot of turmoil in that career, but in a good way.
They say in the tech world, don't they, that failure is very important.
It is. It is. It's a very important point of reflection on oneself. I think a problem many people have is they think they are who they play. And but de facto, most of the time, you are playing a role. So you're a bit like an actor who believes that he is Hamlet. But he's not Hamlet. Hamlet is Shakespeare's ownership. You're just an actor. And at the evening when the play is over, you put your robe in the wardrobe and you go home and you're Mr. Whoever, X or Y, again. And but you need to understand that, because often people do not do that reflection on themselves.
Mm. While you were undergoing your successful business career, to what extent were you still practicing your art?
Yeah, I was still practicing my art on the side. So I was still drawing and I was doodling a lot in meetings, also doing little portraits from whatever other people and surroundings. I like to do that. I'm anyway, let's say, at my heart, somebody who loves to draw. I see that as my core discipline. And out of drawing comes then everything else, comes sculpting, comes painting. But I'm always spending a lot of time and thinking on drawing. And that's what I practice mainly.
So when you decided to, in 2015, to concentrate on art more fully, I know you still sit on the board of some investment banks and companies and so on, but when you decided to devote much more time to your art, was that a case of the urge gradually overcoming you? Or was it a case of, well, I've achieved a lot of success and wealth and so on, now I can afford to do what I want?
No, I think it was the urge, because if you look at it, pretty much from 2010 onwards, I was really having two jobs. One was my business job, so my official job, and the other one was my artist job. And that was quite intense. I was somewhere doing paintings at 30 to later 50, 60 hours a week in parallel to my normal job. So I kind of said, this cannot go on forever, right? Otherwise, yeah, it just doesn't work. You have no social life anymore. No. Because you are working on two fronts all the time. So you need to decide. And I simply felt that I wanted to really focus fully on my art. And I felt that I'm young enough to do that. And if I would have waited another 10 or 15 years, which is what normally people would do, then it would risk simply to become a hobby instead of being my true core activity, right? And so that led me to take the decision to leave things completely behind, which is quite rare that people actually are willing to do that, because you leave a lot behind.
Mm. And what sort of art, what sort of drawing, painting were you doing at that time?
Yeah, mainly watercolor. I mean, I'm really started always with watercolor paintings. They were called urban portraits. And they were always paintings which were critical reflection on our society, in particular on elements like we as humans always have this ambition to be perfect, doll-like, Barbie-like, Instagram influencer-like, all these things. And so I always liked to address that subject matter in my paintings.
Well, let's take one. I'm looking at one at the moment called MMT, and you have Wall Street in the background. You have a bull raging through, like a bull market, a Barbie doll sitting on top of a man who's being pushed out of the way by the bull, and an executive jet in the background. What was your main idea behind that?
Yeah, so MMT means modern monetary theory. And basically, that's right now the driving theory of all the governments and central Western governments and central banks. And in a nutshell, the theory says we can print as much money as we want as long as we are printing currency and we can't go bankrupt. But we can basically restart the economy. That's the basic theory. That's why the US is printing, Europe is printing, and everybody else is printing so much money. And I believe that's a fallacy because at the end of the day, you have to somehow, you have to pay for it. Either you pay for it through inflation, through devaluation of currencies, or through higher taxes, and then potentially through depression. And the theme which I addressed there has been a core theme in Goethe's Faust. Goethe's thought about money printing as a way which was seen at the time as a way to simply overcome economic difficulties, which worked short term, but then typically led to a disaster. In Goethe's Faust, it led to a second war. And so I'm picking up that theme as it is topical to the work I have done with on Faust from Goethe, and now bringing Faust into the context of our current world, our current discussion on MMT, which is, in my views, going in the wrong direction, right? And the bull symbolizes the bull of Wall Street, and the guy who is falling off of him is Mephisto, the devil, who has helped the emperor print, introduce paper money.
Well, we'll talk more about Faust. One of the things that you've put a lot in your urban portraits are sort of half-nude women. Do they represent the kind of stereotype for you?
They do in a way. I'm being a figurative painter. My subject matter is basically the human person, right? If I say it in a neutral way, so man or woman. And I always have figurative subject matter. So you won't see me painting abstract or painting just a landscape. It will always be a figurative painting. And what I like to do is I like to stage my story through the composition. Right. And the, let's say, women have obviously a big importance in that context.
Yeah, they're quite surreal. There's narrative going on. And you also mix historical works, don't you, with contemporary references?
Yeah.
You do that as well in your works pertaining to Faust. And you, of course, made a full-length feature film, The Last Faust. How did that develop?
Funnily enough, one of these also organic projects, which sounds a bit strange because it led to a full feature film at the end of the day. But the way it developed is I always admired the illustrations done by Paolo Arrigo, or then also of Dali, which I had seen in Florence on the Dante's Inferno. What I wanted to do is really an illustration or visualization of a major piece of literature, which for me is important. And I knew Faust from school, obviously, but I had never read Faust 2. But I liked the core of the story, which is that a genius or a scientist sells his souls to the devil to get progress, and is being tricked in all kinds of things by the devil throughout his life then. So I liked that idea, and then I picked up the book, Faust, and I discovered the second part of Faust, which is so much richer and so much more intense, but has never really been played in theater, because to do it, it requires 13 hours. So it has been done like a few times with some very dedicated people over weekends, with different crews playing or casts playing in tandem. So I thought, okay, it's a phenomenal subject. And let me try to bring it down to what its core is. from my perspective. So basically, if you want, did a compression in something which lasts more or less than 2 hours. And then once that was ready, I started doing drawings as visualization. So that's my first illustration, if you want. So the idea at the beginning was only to do staged settings with actors to have enough reference material for my paintings and sculptures. And out of that then grew over time a full photo collection. And out of that grew over time a full feature film.
You must have learned an extraordinary number of things in that process.
It was phenomenal. Indeed. A steep learning curve, I must say.
The hyperreal photography you mentioned, you have dance sequences in the film. You wrote the screenplay too. I mean that must have been exhilarating, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it was quite phenomenal. But there is a saying where the stars are aligned. So sometimes you have a series of good coincidences, and your mind is open enough to notice and to pick it up. And so, for example, my wife is a very good photographer. And then I met this guy who is a phenomenal CGI artist, and he showed me what kind of surreal photos one can develop on the computer. So I started discussing with him, could we recreate my drawings in photos? He said, oh, no problem. So we discovered, I discovered a completely new possibility to create artworks through photography through him. And we were sitting side by side. And he had the tools, and I knew what I wanted, and we could then develop that series together. And the same was true with the film. I found a very good director of photography and film director in Germany, Dominik Wischermann, and he had all the necessary skills, and I knew what I wanted. So again, together, we were able to pull it off, and I did all the organization part of it as well.
In your version of Faust, you have updated it so that the pact with the devil is like a hedge fund manager. And if Faust is ever satisfied, he takes his soul, which in this case is all the digital information. There are clear references to people like Steve Jobs, because Faust starts off really like a Harvey Weinstein, doesn't he? Seducing young women and causing mayhem. And then he becomes the kind of Steve Jobs because he's wearing jeans and a polo neck sweater. Do you see Steve Jobs personally as somebody who represents this idea of technological overreach? Someone who I think one of your characters says he never stopped to reflect on his actions.
No, so I think the big tech leaders are very typical false characters. On the positive side, they create technologies which really bring the world quite amazingly forward. But what most also do, which is also normal, is they neglect the downsides of the technology. So, for example, Google has been a big promoter of AI. They launched the quantum computer. The guy who was managing Google Brains at the time was called Dr. Goodfellow. And so they are all working on amazing things and amazing technology, which will be over time then also realized or is being realized. Now, each of the technologies we are creating these days has real downsides. And the more amazing the technological breakthrough is, the bigger the downsides are. So, for example, if you take AI, I mean, there is no way on earth that you can control a technology which is superior to the one who has created it. It just doesn't work. Right? But we haven't seen AI yet, because for AI, you need quantum computing, which is now workable, but now being brought over the next 5 years, let's say, to a marketable level. So in the next 5 to 15 years, we will see true AI, meaning self-learning machines. And if they are better than the creator, why would they not bother getting rid of the creator, especially if the creator is full of flaws and creates environmental problems and wars and all kind of things?
Yeah, I think in your film, I remember, I think it's Mephisto said, if humans are no longer needed, then there'll be no more need for the devil.
Yeah, that's a problem for the devil. For me, let's say the most dangerous technology we have, in my view right now, is AI. And the most dangerous situation we have is that the number of hyper-dangerous technologies we have is so big that the likelihood that something will go wrong is simply very small. Like if I remember when I was a child, the only fear there was the nuclear bomb and Russia overrunning Europe and throwing a nuclear bomb. That was, let's say, the only true fear, because that was the only technology which had the potential to destroy everybody. If you fast forward to today, I mean, we have tons of technologies that can destroy everybody, starting with diseases of all kind of things, chemical, biological, DNA-based, whatever. So AI, so we have plenty of it to make sure that we are risking ourselves, right? So I just think the likelihood is becoming higher that we're doing things now which are simply risking ourselves. A step up, you could argue, so what? Yeah, maybe it's better for the world, and human race has only been around for a little time. But I think we're playing with fire. We have sold our souls.
So what do we do about it, Philip?
That's the problem. I don't know. I don't think we can seriously do anything about it. The problem is simply you can't stop human curiosity. And if you can't stop it, ultimately you can't control it, because human curiosity is so ingenious that it develops things out of curiosity which simply will become too difficult to control. I'm not optimistic for us overall.
It's Faust all over again, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's why when I read Faust 1 and 2 again, I said, there is not a better description of where we are as a society today than Faust. And that's why I felt this urge to de-dust it, basically, from its medieval touch and transfer it into the heart of our tech world, right, which is Silicon Valley.
So do you think machines will become self-aware?
Sure.
And they'll get rid of, I think, what one of your characters says, pesky emotions.
Yeah. Because emotions are dangerous, right? Because of emotions, we do wars. Because of emotions, we have economic cycles. Normally, if you take the economy should grow every year globally by 2%. It doesn't, because people get emotional and they create booms and busts, right? That's how we are. It makes us charming, but dangerous.
But I mean, emotions are the key to human behavior, aren't they?
They are. So it's our strengths, but at the same time, our ingenuity is creating then its own risk, right? And it happens.
Will you continue to pursue these themes in your art?
Yeah. What I like to understand is simply, I think it's important that we as humans understand ourselves with our own mortality, yeah, clearly understood. So within the time frame we have, and try to understand ourselves depleted, let's say, of external attributes. So our own core. And we also need to understand what our role is then in the world we are living in, and what our actions mean. So these are always the subjects which I find fascinating and will always be coming through my art.
When you were CEO of Vodafone and all the other companies, did you notice leaders carrying on without kind of reflecting on human qualities and certain responsibilities that they had?
I think at the end of the day, as a leader of a large company, on one hand, you are trying, let's say, to make sure that you are delivering also on the promises you did, like, for example, on the decarbonization or other promises you did as a company. But then in reality, you are really caught between making sure that you deliver the financials and the market shares of your company, because that will ultimately then mean that you are successful on and the company is successful or not. And that kind of takes away the attention of saying, what else is there in society? And in a way, the problem is simply, and it's the same with environmental issues, right? So if you create a problem which you are not paying for, and somebody else is taking care of, you don't really care for it. So if you produce, let's say, a great shampoo, and you put it in a plastic bottle, but you are not paying for getting rid of the plastic bottle, but somebody else is, and then it's not being taken care of here in the UK, but it's being shipped to Malaysia or somewhere else and then being burned there, then you don't really care. Yeah, in concrete actions. You care in it theoretically, like everybody does, but you don't really say, okay, I'm going to really change my company now and make sure that this is not happening. You would like to, because you are not bad. It's just you are being caught, if you want, in your own limitations and priorities. And that's simply a problem we have, that we create things which cost other people money, and we don't have to pay for it.
Although companies have wisened up a little about things like plastic waste, haven't they?
Yeah.
We've been talking in rather pessimistic tones about the future of mankind. Do you think those little things perhaps help us on a daily basis?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm absolutely optimistic that we will be able to reverse our environmental problems through the help of technology. So I don't see that as, for me, my main concern. I mean, it's on the way, it's obviously dangerous a bit, and we will have catastrophes and problems, but I think it is something that is fixable through technology. So I'm quite optimistic in many areas. I think through medicine, we will make massive advances, which will prolong life, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very optimistic on that sense. I'm just not optimistic on the total Molotov cocktail we are creating, whether that is something we can control.
Well, on a slightly optimistic note, we'll end it there. Thank you very much for giving us insight into your thoughts, Philip, and it's been a real pleasure.
Well, pleasure from my side as well. Thank you. And looking forward to meeting in person one day, hopefully.
Indeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Philip Hamm, and I've put a few examples of his work on the Considering Art website. Thanks for listening. This is Bob Chaundy saying, take care.